flying to its death. It bucks and jumps until most of the tarp slips off the back. And there it is, standing in Henna's car. Its neck is obviously broken. So are its legs. But it stands on them seemingly without pain. It shakes the flies from its hide, and I can hear a horrible snap as its neck mostly rights itself. Then it looks down at me. Its eyes glow blue, actually glow. And on my back in a soggy ditch as it stands over me, it's pretty much all I can do not to wet myself. Then it looks past me, into the woods from where all the deer came that night. It leaps gingerly, gracefully, out of the car, over the ditch, and onto the ground. Its legs are nightmarish. No way they should be able to support its weight. But they do, and with a snort, it heads off into the trees, disappearing from sight. Chapter the 8th, in which Satchel, Dylan, and second indie kid Finn throw themselves into research in the library, trying to find any mention of the Immortals. Later that week, at Kerouac's funeral, Satchel's parents hug her and give her space to grieve. Meanwhile, the court of the Immortals, unable to live in this world for more than brief periods, begins its search for permanent vessels in earnest. They find Satchel's uncle, passed out in his police cruiser on a dark wooded road known for its nighttime activities. "Sandra," he says on waking, just before his head is removed from his shoulders, not entirely painlessly. B.
"But I've got German to study," Meredith says, still protesting from the back seat, holding up her German worksheets.
"Don't you like miniature golf?" I say.
"No one likes miniature golf," she says. "You don't like it either. You're just doing it ironically."
"Well, that's probably true. Hannah can't even hold a club, and it was her idea."
"I still don't see why I have to come."
"She has to come because no one goes out alone anymore. Ever since the zombie deer, ever since two indie kids died. Me and Jared only do shifts together at Griller's. Mel claims she needs to study for finals, so gets out of all her night hours at the drugstore. And Henna's off work from the Java Shack anyway because of her arm. My mom is down at the Capitol more and more for her campaign, so Mel and I take over driving Meredith to her nightly lessons. And prom night, under 3 weeks away now, tick-tock, with all of us going together, is now definitely on. Nathan included, and Dr. Call Me Steve a late addition, because we don't think it's safe any other way. Fun, fun, fun." Mel glances in the rearview mirror. "Quit complaining, or we won't take you to Bolts of Fire." "Mom hasn't said yes yet, remember?" I say, as Mel pulls onto our little bit of freeway. "And we can still make her say no."
"She'll say yes," Meredith insists. "I've already got the tickets." "Oh."
She says the last like she's revealed too much. Which she has. I turn around in my seat. "You want to say that again?" Meredith looks panicked, and I can see her brain whirring as she tries to think of an explanation.
"Meredith,"
Mel warns. Meredith sighs in defeat.
"I already got the tickets."
"When?" Mel asks. "How?" I say.
"My credit card,"
Meredith says quietly.
"Your what?"
Mel asks, her voice as sharp as a paper cut. Meredith stays quiet.
"Mom got you a credit card, didn't she?"
"It's not mine," Meredith says. "It's linked to Mom's." "Does it have your name on it?" I ask.
"Well, yes, but..."
"I don't believe this," Mel says with a harsh laugh.
"That woman!"
"You both have jobs," Meredith complains. "I had no way of buying things for myself."
"You're 10, Meredith,"
I say.
"Don't call me that. She got tired of always having to input the number for my online music courses."
"So she got you your own card," Mel says, "because that's the most logical solution to that non-problem."
"I wasn't supposed to tell you."
"I wonder why." Mel's voice is angrily light.
God knows she treats us all equally, so why would there be any problem?
I'm being really responsible with it.
Bolts of fire tickets weren't responsible, I say. Meredith looks shifty.
She won't get the bill until after the concert.
This actually makes both Mel and me laugh out loud.
I only had a short time for the fan club tickets, Meredith rushes on. If I didn't get them then, I'd never have gotten them. Anyway, they came in the mail yesterday.
She smiles like the sun rising.
3 tickets.
Why 3? Mel asks.
You could have just gotten 2.
Cheaper. Less trouble later.
You said you'd both take me, Meredith says. It's more fun if we're all there together.
The simple love in the way she says this makes my heart hurt a little bit. Yeah, my parents are crappy, but you hurt either of my sisters, and I will spend my life finding ways to destroy you.
That's a pretty big gamble you're taking on Mom saying yes,
Mel says, already exiting the freeway. Told you it was little.
She always says yes to me eventually, Meredith says. I don't know why.
The mini golf place is literally right by the freeway exit, so Mel's already pulling into the lot. She parks and says without malice,
it's because you're the best of us, Meredith.
Meredith looks at me.
I don't think that.
It's why you're with us tonight, I say. We couldn't leave you home alone.
Dad's there.
Exactly.
Is this because of all the strange stuff going on?
She asks, almost as if she's afraid we'll answer. Mel and I exchange a glance, and decide silently in about half a second that we're not going to lie to her.
Yeah,
I say. All the strange stuff. Meredith nods seriously.
I thought so.
We get out of the car. I see Henna waving to us with her good hand from the little hut where you get your putters. She's with...
Jared's here,
Meredith says happily.
But who's that?
And I say, that's Nathan. I only make it to the first hole, where I discover that even a week after the accident, the slight torso twist to make a putt in mini golf is too much for a still aching muscle in my back. Jared surreptitiously heals it, while Mel and Nathan take their turns.
Sore?
Henna asks from a bench next to Meredith, who's practicing her German conjugations. It's mostly better, I say, sitting down next to her gingerly. Every once in a while I get surprised by something I didn't know was hurting.
Me too,
she says, running her fingers along her cast.
Jared helped.
Jared has rejoined Mel and Nathan at the first hole, which is decorated with little plastic dinosaurs. Mel takes her putt, then thrusts 2 fists in the air.
Hole in one,
she shouts. Mel is ridiculously ace at mini golf.
I'm surprised your parents let you come out, I say to Henna.
And you would be right in your surprise, she says.
Ich schreibe, du schreibst, schreibt,
Meredith whispers next to us.
But nearly dying seems to have made a whole bunch of things clearer,
Henna says.
Don't you think?
Not really, if I'm honest.
It has for me.
Jared and Nathan and Mel are all laughing at Nathan's inability to get the ball in the hole. You're supposed to give up at 7 strokes, we hear Jared say.
I told my parents I was going out to see you guys,
Henna says.
They didn't want me to, but I didn't ask permission. Amazing the difference it makes. Being firm, being clear.
Your mom and dad are right to be worried, though.
2 kids are dead. They probably won't be the last.
Meredith pauses for a moment, then goes back to conjugating.
Ich möchte, sie möchten.
That's actually the reason I gave,
Henna says.
I could have died. We could have died in that car accident. But we didn't. I could die at home just as easily as I could die out with my friends. Or, you know, in the Central African Republic.
Ah.
Yeah. Ah.
She's looking right at me. I don't know what her eyes mean. I don't feel any clearer, I'm surprised to hear myself saying. I just feel like my body is in all these different pieces, and even though it looks like I'm all put together, the pieces are really just floating there, and if I fall down too hard, I'll fly apart.
Like a fontanelle,
Hannah says.
A what?
The soft spot on top of a baby's head.
She taps the spot on her own head.
Babies' skulls aren't fused together when they're born, otherwise they're too big to get out of the mother. They've got this spot called a fontanelle that's just kind of unprotected until the hardness grows in.
That makes sense, I say. I'm just one big fontanelle. Hannah laughs lightly. Then she takes my hand in hers and holds it.
Mikey,
she says.
But not like she's about to say anything more, just like she's identifying me, making a place for me here that's mine to exist in. I want her so much my heart feels heavy, like I'm grieving. Is this what they meant about that stomach feeling? They didn't say it felt this sad.
The mini golf park is old and really narrow, so even though Jared, Mel, and Nathan are already on hole number 3, they're still pretty much just right there, laughing, looking over to where we sit. Especially Nathan.
Ich esse, wir essen.
Meredith looks up.
I'm hungry.
Just what I was thinking, Nathan calls. Hannah lets go of my hand. Anyone want any food? Nathan asks, coming over.
A hot dog, Meredith says.
Nathan raises his eyebrows.
A hot dog, please,
Meredith says.
I'll help you,
Hannah says, getting up. She looks back to me.
You want anything, Mikey? Ich liebe,
Meredith mutters under her breath.
Du liebst.
I aim a sideways kick at her. Nah, I'm good. I watch them head back to the hut that sells your standard mini golf food, hot dogs and nachos. I watch Hannah go inside with Nathan. Jared's watching too. Then he looks at me, and I know what he's thinking. He's thinking it's long past time I gave Hannah up. And maybe he's right.
But she held my hand again, and said she was seeing things more clearly.
I wish I was.
Two!
Mel shouts triumphantly. Midway through our second round of mini golf, Mel won the first with a score of 59. Jared had 80, Nathan 97, which was pleasing. We have a surprise visitor. Hey! A tired-looking Dr. Call Me Steve says, holding his car keys, still wearing hospital scrubs.
Hey!
Mel says, every word of her body language turning into a smile.
You came.
Who could say no to putt-putt golf?
Almost anybody,
Meredith says, writing down answers about the adventures of Dieter and Frederica in Hamburg. Can I play in? Steve asks, after Mel introduces him around. Wow, he said, gently palpating my nose. That's healing amazingly fast. You can have my spot, Nathan says. I'm doing so bad you'll be lucky to break 100. Steve takes Nathan's putter. I like a challenge. We were on the new course at the back of the mini golf place, though it's only new like New Mexico is new. It used to be jungle themed, but the statues of natives were so racist they all had to be removed. Now it's just leafy with one chipped paint fiberglass tiger in the middle, emitting a tinny, pre-recorded roar every 4 minutes. Hannah immediately joined Mel at the arrival of Dr. Steve, for moral support, I guess. So Meredith and I get Nathan all to ourselves on the bench. Yippee. How you feeling, Mike? He says, sitting down between us.
Oh, you know, I say, not meeting his eye. Just the physical and emotional fallout of a near-death experience. Nothing big.
He laughs, which I find irritating.
I know,
he says, which I find even more irritating. I get up. Anyone want any more food?
Nine,
Meredith says, crunching a nacho.
Ich habe viele nachos.
You don't like me,
Nathan says, and I stop.
Who says I don't like you?
Every single vibe coming off you? Unless I'm wrong. I hesitate,
not on purpose, just long enough to make it awkward.
I suppose I kind of get it, he says.
You're already 90% out of here, aren't you? All you want to do now is spend the last weeks as close to your friends as possible, because you don't want to think about leaving them behind when you go. But here comes this interloper, breaking up your tight-knit group right at the time you want it the most.
Well, I say, yeah.
He looks at his hands, flexing them and unflexing them.
When we lived in Florida, my sister was a full-on indie kid, so I became kind of a mascot to them. The little one,
he glances at Meredith, who tagged along and said funny things. He looks at his hands again.
And then the vampires came. My sister fell in love. Before it was all over, she and every one of her friends were dead.
Oh, no,
Meredith says, wide-eyed.
My mom's been moving around ever since from base to base, keeping busy so she never has to think about it. But we show up here, and now there's two dead kids, and I don't know anyone.
Yeah, I say. Yeah, all right. We're quiet for a second. Then I say,
you know, Hannah's older brother.
I know, he says. Cool to talk to someone who knows what it's like.
Shit. I mean, come on. How am I supposed to react to all of this? How am I supposed to hate him now?
You have a really stupid haircut, I say. I'm self-conscious about my ears, he says. There's a burst of laughter from the golfers, and we look up to see Mel pulling a sheepish Dr. Steve out of the 6-inch-deep water trap.
We good? Nathan asks.
Oh, God, I groan. We were until you said, we good.
Mel and Dr. Steve head off to a late dinner together, so I take her car to drive Meredith home. Jared drives himself, and Nathan gives Hannah a lift. Before they go, Hannah hugs me.
Clear doesn't mean I know what to do,
she says so only I can hear it.
It's just that the accident made it clear how important you are to me, Mikey, how much I love you.
Just not in your stomach. I try to smile.
She doesn't say anything for a second, then...
You working Sunday?
No, I say. Getting graduation pictures in the afternoon. I'll be under about 5 inches of makeup.
Pick me up after, she says. I'll skip evening church. Let's do something. Just the two of us.
Okay.
Okay?
Okay.
And then she leaves. With Nathan. Meredith falls asleep singing Bold Sapphire while we're driving home. She wakes up once and says,
I wish you and Mel weren't going away.
Then she curls into herself and goes back to sleep.
Chapter the 9th, in which Satchel visits the police station looking for her uncle. The other officers are stern with her, and she sees a glowing blue deep in their eyes. Her uncle, wearing a scarf despite the heat of the day, has the same glow. He threatens Satchel, and she flees the police station, finding second indie kid Finn at her house. For a moment, it seems like he might kiss her, but she touches the amulet and sees another flash of the handsomest boy she's ever seen. It's so strong, she has to run up to her room so she can ruminate alone.
B. Did you ask him yet?
It's not really that simple,
Jared says.
And he's not really a he. You look like you're being treated for burns. I touch the makeup the photographer has slapped on me like frosting on a cake. My fingertips come away peach.
Don't touch it,
she yells from where she's setting up the camera. Maybe I should just go with the black eyes, I tell Jared. At least the bandages are off, he says.
Yeah, thanks.
So did you ask him, or her, or them? It's a bit less certain than that with some gods, but yes. I asked the god of deer about your deer zombie.
And?
Nothing. Hadn't heard about it. Looked into it, said, beyond my realms,
What does that mean?
It means whatever this is, it's nothing to do with the gods.
He squints and rubs his nose. No makeup for him.
Look, Mike, most gods don't care.
About what?
About anything, other than gaining dominance over other gods and telling you how wonderful they are and demanding that you say the same.
There's some feeling in his voice when he says it.
There's nothing like a bunch of gods to show you how alone you really are.
Dude, I say, I'm sitting right here. You're not alone.
You're up, the photographer says to me. And make it quick. That stuff's gonna turn into a lava flow under these lights.
Wow, that's a lot of makeup,
Mr. Shuren says when we stop by Jared's house after the photos are done.
Hi, Mr. Shuren, I say. You look like a TV anchorman.
Jared and Mr. Shuren hug in greeting. They always have, even now when Jared is basically a giant over his father.
He's a good guy, Mr. Shuren. Even short and kinda soft, you can still see why a half-goddess might enjoy his company.
I'm afraid it's officially going to be me against your mom again, Mike, he says. The state party even hired me a proper campaign team.
He shrugs.
That'll be new.
We'll be two states away, I say. So good luck. Text me the result or something.
He smiles, but he looks tired.
There's no way he's going to win, and he knows it. But the other party has to put up somebody.
Mr. Sherman's never said exactly why he always runs, but my guess would be that my mom's party tends to not be so thrilled with people who are different. There's a lot of different in Mr. Sherman's life.
It looks like it might be wearing on him, though. He's got more gray hair on his temples than even last month. It never really occurred to me to wonder how me and Mel moving out will affect my parents, because realistically, the answer's got to be not that much. But Jared's an only child. He's really close to his dad, and his mom isn't around anymore. Funny how you can forget that every family isn't like yours.
I really want to go and wash off my face, but Mr. Shuren sticks a Coke in my hand and pulls a pizza he's obviously had waiting for us out of the oven. We sit and eat, flakes of makeup falling onto my pepperoni.
Jared asked you about the cabin? Mr. Shuren says.
I look up, chewing cheese.
What?
After prom.
Dad wants us to throw a party out there, Jared says.
When we're done dancing.
Not a party, Mr. Shuren says. The prom's a party. This would be an after party, a chill out.
Jared winces at his dad's ancient slang.
Look, Mr. Shuren says, I know you guys are going to drink and hang out somewhere, so why not do it in a safe place no one has to drive home from?
The cabin he's talking about is a decent-sized, if cheaply made, shack out on the far, meaning poor, end of the big glacial lake. To call it basic would be an optimistic use of basic. But I've been a bunch of times with them in the summer over the years, and it's fine. They had a bit of an otter problem not too long ago, but the musk and rotting fish smell must have faded by now.
Sounds fun to me, I say. Aside from it being exactly the sort of situation where we'll all be murdered by a skin-eating serial killer or something.
Jared barely responds. He's been preoccupied since at least this morning.
Actually, it's been longer than that, hasn't it?
Now that I think about it. Now that I think about something other than myself.
Oh, damn. Have I missed something? Am I letting my best friend down somehow?
Well, it's there. The idea, Mr. Shuren says. If you want it.
He takes a bite of pizza.
You boys doing anything tonight?
He means together. I shake my head.
I'm meeting Henna.
Mr. Shuren brightens.
A date? At last?
Yes. Everyone knows. Everyone.
I don't think so, I say. More a car crash survivors meeting.
Mr. Sherman nods, then looks at Jared.
You going out?
Says Jared, wiping his mouth on a napkin.
He stands and opens the back door where we came in. A dozen neighborhood cats sit outside patiently.
Give me a minute, Jared says. It's the third time through washing my face that I know I'm screwed. I'm in Jared's bathroom, and I wash in a particular order, of course, being me. I splash water on myself from the sink and rub some of Jared's medium fancy face soap into my forehead. Upper corners first with both hands, then circles to the center. I move down my nose, washing either side 4, 5, 6 times, out across my cheekbones, my hands working in mirror, then my cheeks, gently on the still healing scar, and across my chin with my right hand. Both hands wash under my neck, dripping water on the collar of my t-shirt. Rinse with 1, 2, 3 splashes of water, then a towel in the same pattern to dry it. The first time I do it, whole slabs of makeup come off. I'm going to look like an Easter Island head in my senior pictures. So I wash again in the same exact order. Third time through, I know I'm gone. Forehead, nose, cheekbones, chin, neck. Forehead, nose, cheekbones, chin, neck. Forehead, nose, cheekbones, chin, neck. Shit, 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 shit. My shirt is soaking wet now. I can feel my fingertips starting to crack again as the oil is washed away. The repeated washing of my black eyes and cheek scar, no matter how gently I do it, gets more painful each time. The eighth time through, I try to force my hands to rest on the sink and fail. I know how crazy this is. I know the feeling that I haven't washed my face right makes no sense. But like I said, knowing doesn't make it better. It makes it so much worse. How can I explain it? If you don't know, maybe I can't, but as I wash my face yet again, I hate myself so much I want to stick a knife in my heart. When Jared finally opens the bathroom door to see what's going on, I'm actually crying. With fury. With embarrassment. With hate for myself and this stupid thing I can't stop doing. I'm doing it again even now, knowing all of those things. Jared takes one look, disappears for a sec, and returns with a dry shirt. One of mine I've left here over the years. The simple act of taking it from him breaks the loop. I bend forward at the waist and say a long, angry, "Fuck!" under my breath. I'm still crying, so Jared just puts his hand on my back until I'm ready to stand up again. "There's no shame in therapy, Mike," he says as I change shirts. "Or medicine. You shouldn't have to go through this." The skin on my face is now so dry it stings. Jared finds some man moisturizer and holds it out to me. "Can you do it?" I say. "I'm afraid I'll get stuck again." He doesn't question me, just starts dabbing the goop on my face. "Is it going out with henna tonight? You're afraid it's changing. That could be it." "Maybe." I wince as the cream bites a bit. "Maybe it's you." He pauses. "Me?" I try to smile. "Who's going to save me from these when I go to college?" "You'll work it out, Mikey. You're stronger than you think, and I'll be there anyway." "It's not just that. Where have you been lately, Jared? Where do you go on Saturday nights? What are you doing tonight that no one can know about?" He puts more stuff on my face. And yeah, I know most people would think it weird that two guy friends touch as much as we do. But when you choose your family, you get to choose how it is between you two. This is how we work. I hope you get to choose your family, and I hope it means as much to you as mine does to me. "I got some stuff going on, Mike," he says. "What stuff? I can help you with it." He smiles. "Not this stuff, but thank you. You could talk to me about it. You can talk to me about anything." "I know." He finishes with the moisturizer. "You're going to be shiny, but you've known henna so long, I doubt she really sees you anymore." "Jared, here's what's important, Mike." He takes a long time screwing the lid back on the moisturizer. "What's important is that I know how much you worry about shit. And what's also important is that I know a big part of that worry is that no matter what group of friends you're in, no matter how long you've known them, you always assume you're the least wanted person there, the one everyone else could do without." All I can do with this is swallow. I feel like I'm naked all of a sudden. "Even when it's just you and me," he says, I know how you worry that you need me as a friend more than I need you.
Jared, please. I've known it since we were kids, Mike. You're not the only one who worries.
He play punches me in the chest, leaving the flat of his fist there.
I wouldn't have made it without you. I got my dad, and I got you, and I need you both. More than you know.
I swallow again.
Thanks, man.
I'll tell you about everything when I can, he says. I promise. I want to. But talking about it even with you would change it, and I can't risk that yet.
Okay.
And if you don't kiss Hannah on the lips tonight for real, I'll make sure you have black eyes all the way through graduation.
He grins. And though I'm still worried about him,
I wouldn't be me if I wasn't.
The happiness I feel at what he said is just like he really did punch me in the chest.
Would it be okay if I kissed you?
Hannah asks before we're even half a mile from her house. I stop right there in the middle of the road.
What?
Is pretty much all I can come up with.
It's kind of in the spirit of exploration,
she says.
We've both always wondered, haven't we?
We have? You have?
You're a cute boy I've known for 100 years. Of course I've thought about it.
A car pulls up behind us in the wooded dark, its headlights shining on the backs of our heads. After a second, it honks. Without taking my eyes off Hannah, I hit the hazard lights. The car honks again, then pulls around us.
Don't you feel like the world's shaken loose? Hannah says.
Yes, I say, because it has. You think I'm cute?
Here's this future we're looking at, and it's not far away like the future normally is. It's here, now, like any second.
She rubs her shoulder.
I got vaccinated for the Africa trip today. We're still going, even when I've just had surgery on my arm. My dad says he's a doctor, and he can look after me, and God will watch over us as we do his will, and so nothing's changed. We're going, and it's real.
You could stay with us, I say. And then I think, no, she probably couldn't. She knows it too from the look she gives me.
Or Jared, for the summer at least. No,
she says, shaking her head.
It's happening. There's nothing I can do about it. There's nothing I can do about graduating. Nothing I can do about going to a different college than all of my friends. Nothing I can do about these feelings for Nathan that surprise me as much as anybody. Sorry, but what's the point of lying about it? What's the point of lying about anything? We could keep being too afraid to say we don't know stuff, and then the future will come and eat us anyway, and we'll regret not doing all that stuff we wished we did. You know?
Not really. She smiles.
There's the truth, see? Isn't it great?
Another car passes us going the other way. It goes pretty slowly, though, and we wait for it to pass, as if it could somehow overhear our conversation.
Why do you want to kiss me?
I ask.
Because I don't know if I should. I don't know what it'll feel like.
She shrugs.
I used to like you that way. Way back when Mel started school again. I could see how much you cared for her, Mike. How much you looked after her.
Her eyes have gone a little wet.
I don't know if Timu would have looked after me like that in the same situation.
She swallows away the tears.
I'd like to think so, but I'm never going to find out. And I don't like that I'm not.
I'm just staring at her.
You used to like me?
Yeah, she says simply.
But I was with Tony, and I also liked him. A lot. Still do.
We'd have had the most incredibly pretty black Finnish Korean babies in the world.
Why'd you break up with him then?
She finally looks away.
He wanted us to get married this summer.
What?
I thought about it too, as a way to get out of the Africa trip. But then I realized that was the only reason I was considering it. You can't marry someone just to get away from your parents.
People do.
Not me, it turns out. It also made me realize I couldn't see myself marrying Tony at all. Not yet, anyway. At least, not until I'd gone out and had a life of my own, where I could make my own decisions. Maybe find out what I want.
And you want to find out if you want me? She looks back at me,
We could have died together, but we didn't. And all I could think while we were waiting for the ambulance was how glad I was it was you with me there. Because if it was you, I didn't have to be afraid.
I felt the same way.
I know. I've always known.
She unbuckles her seatbelt.
I don't know if it's the right thing for us to kiss, but I don't want to leave not having found out. I'm not trying to play with your feelings, and I'm so scared you might get hurt, but being too afraid isn't...
And I'm already kissing her.
She's...
Well, I don't know. You've kissed people, haven't you? So you know what the physical part is, and though we do just fine at that, and the closeness, and the smell of her, and the taste of her mouth is so freaking amazing, and though I can feel every part of where she's touching me with her non-injured hand on the back of my neck, and her cast digging into my chest, and yeah, I have such a hard-on, I have to readjust myself before we kiss again because it's so uncomfortable against my jeans, but it's really inside your head where it all happens, doesn't it? Because I'm just thinking, I'm kissing her, I'm kissing her, I'm kissing her, I'm kissing Hannah, we're kissing, it's Hannah and we're kissing. And maybe that's stupid, but maybe it's not. Maybe that's just what people do. I'm kissing her. That's what I'm thinking.
There's a knock on the window so loud and surprising we jump apart. A car has stopped a little behind us, its headlights off. I have no reason to think so, but I have the immediate thought that it's the same car that stopped behind us before, and the same car that drove by slowly a minute ago. It turns on red and blue lights to flash at us once or twice before going dark again. It's a police car.
Shit,
I hear Hannah say. We haven't done anything wrong, I say. The knock comes again, and we both jump again, too. I don't think either of us are especially afraid of policemen, but two people have been killed, and a zombie deer jumped over my head, so I think it's fair to say we're a little on edge. I roll down my window. The cop is standing so close to the car, I can't even see his face at first. I do see the big truncheon-like flashlight that he knocked on the window with. It's about 2 inches from my head.
Hi,
I say,
kind of stupidly.
Hi, he says, leaning down slow to put his head in the window. Is that how you address an officer of the law?
With shock, I recognize him. It's the cop who came to the school and completely failed to take us seriously when we said we'd seen Indie Kid Finn being chased by a little girl across the field. He's wearing a scarf, which clearly isn't part of his uniform, and it's pitch black, and he's wearing sunglasses.
We're in trouble, I think. And not just being stopped by a cop trouble.
I'm waiting for an answer, he says. His words are clear and strong, nothing like the slightly drunk version we saw in the vice principal's office.
I'm sorry, officer. I know we're not supposed to be...
No, he interrupts. You're not.
The flashlight comes on right in my face. I flinch and I hear the cop laugh. He moves it over to Hannah, who doesn't look away. She's frightened, I can tell, as frightened as me. But she's defiant, too. The accident really has shaken the world loose for her. We may be in big trouble here, but if we are, she's going to look at it square on. She's never looked more beautiful, and I'm so afraid for her I can barely keep from throwing up.
You kids, he spits at us, with your impudence and your sex.
Our what?
Hannah says.
Thinking no one understands you because you're young, thinking only you can see the world as it truly is.
He hits the flashlight, hard on the door of my car.
You know nothing.
He hits the door again, hard enough to leave a dent.
Nothing at all.
Almost casually, he smashes my side mirror, shattering it.
Hey!
I say, and the flashlight is suddenly bright in my face again.
It's not safe to be out here at night, the cop says, amusement in his voice.
Still looking at the cop, I try to sneakily raise my hand to the gear shift, wondering if I can gun it and get us out of here.
You try it, the cop says. You just go right ahead.
Mikey,
I hear Hannah whisper.
She's looking out the back window. There are policemen all around us. I don't see any cars beside the first one, but there are at least 20 other cops out there, standing in a wide circle around the car, hands on holsters, all wearing sunglasses. I've still got my hand on the gear shift. Hannah and I both glance down at it, using only our eyes. She gives me a little nod. I'm just about to shift it. When the voice comes, it's like a whisper mixed with the whine of a buzzsaw. It seems to come from everywhere at once, miles away, but also in your head, too.
Look closer,
it says over and over, in scraping words that make both me and Hannah wince.
Look closer, look closer.
The sound is like glass breaking against your skin. You hear it and feel it before it vanishes, making you feel like someone's touched you in a wrong way. The cop turns off his flashlight. I hear Hannah breathing, and I reach out in the darkness to take her hand. She must hear me breathing, too, because she's already reaching out to take mine. The cop takes off his sunglasses. In the pitch darkness, his eyes are glowing. Glowing blue, just like the deer. All around us in the night, the other cops take off their sunglasses, too. A circle of glowing blue eyes watch us in the silence.
Go, Hannah whispers. Just go.
I shift into drive, but the cop's hand shoots in way faster than should be possible and grips my arm, hard enough to hurt. And he's pointing his gun in my face. For a long minute, all I can see is the barrel of that gun.
You aren't the ones we want.
He frowns, sounding disappointed. He lowers the gun, puts his sunglasses back on, and moves away. Out there in the darkness, the blue lights disappear two by two. I don't wait. I step on the gas, and with a burning of wheels, we race off into the night.
Mike,
Hannah says. I know, I say.
Mike,
she says again, just saying my name, not asking anything. I don't even know where I'm going. I'm just driving as fast as I can away and away. I hear Hannah say,
I've never been so happy not to be an indie kid in my entire life.
She starts crying, and we do that for a while. Just drive and cry, mainly out of relief for being alive.
Chapter the 10th, in which indie kids Joffrey and Earth disappear from their homes, their bodies found miles away. Satchel goes into hiding in an abandoned drive-in with fellow indie kids Finn, Dylan, Finn, Lincoln, Archie, Wisconsin, Finn, Aquamarine, and Finn. Seeing a blue light in the night, Satchel meets the boy from the amulet, the handsomest one she's ever seen. He tells her this isn't a safe place for her or the others, and that they should run. Then he tells her she's beautiful in her own special way, and that's when she knows she can trust him. The indie kids go back to their homes.
B. Things get darker in the days after the cop incident. There are two more dead indie kids. I didn't really know either of them except to see them in the hallway at school, but still.
This is worse than when they were all dying beautifully of cancer,
Hannah said. And she's right. The cops are calling one a suicide, and the other a car accident. The cops are saying this. And why should we doubt the cops? Hannah and I told Mel and Jared and, fine, Nathan, what happened, but none of us told our parents. How could we? My dad's automatically out of everything important. I'm not even sure I've seen him this week, just evidence, discarded clothes, snoring, that he's in the house somewhere. My mom's in pre-campaign mode, which is probably not the best time to tell her the local policemen have gone crazy and are threatening her son. I told her I broke the mirror hitting a mailbox. She just sighed and handed me the insurance forms. Hannah's parents would pack her off to a convent, and even Mr. Shuren would be overly concerned and get involved in all the wrong ways. We're just going to stick together and tough it out and try to live long enough to graduate. The usual.
The surviving indie kids disappeared from school for a bit. No one knows where they went. No one knows what they saw there. No one knows why they all came back on the Friday. They won't tell us what's going on, even when we ask them.
What did they say?
Jared asks Mel over lunch.
That we wouldn't understand, Mel says, frowning like she's about to fire the world from a job it loves. But one of them showed me a poem about how we are all essentially alone, as if they're not the biggest clique of togetherness that ever was.
Everyone knows the indie kids don't use the internet. Have you noticed? They never do. It's weird, like it never occurs to them. Like it's still 1985 and there's only card catalogs. So we can't find them discussing anything online. The vibe seems to be that it's totally not our business. Historically, non-indie kids were pretty much left alone by the vampires and the soul-eating ghosts, so maybe they have a point.
But the deer who caused our accident, and the zombie deer coming out of Henna's car, and the scary cops. It's like when adults say world news isn't our worry. Why the hell isn't it?
They don't look like you, Mel says when the prints of my senior photos come in.
I mean, not even a little.
I didn't bother with digital files. I knew they were going to be gruesome. The prints are meant to go into my graduation announcements, the ones with that pointless extra bit of tissue paper and double envelope you send to relatives in the hope they send back money. But maybe even that's out.
You could be your second cousin, maybe,
Henna says, leaning against the counter at the drugstore. We've stopped by Mel's work to check up on her, even though it's broad daylight on a Saturday afternoon.
We don't have any cousins, I say. Dad's an only child, and Uncle Rick doesn't have kids.
Henna blinks.
I've got like 40.
Excuse me?
A skinny, scraggly man says behind us.
For methadone, you need to talk to the pharmacist,
Mel says without even looking up from the photos.
You're not the pharmacist?
The man asks. We all turn to him. He kind of freaks out at the attention, pulling his arms around the heavy metal t-shirt that hangs from his collarbones and shuffling away to the pharmacy counter at the back.
Poor guy,
Mel says. She goes back to my pictures.
You look like a court artist drawing of yourself on the stand.
Henna gasps.
You do look like that.
I move closer to her, pretending to get nearer to my photos. I brush my arm against her arm. It's elementary school shit, but she doesn't move away. It's been over a week since the cops stopped us, but we haven't kissed again or even really talked about it. We've spent a lot of time together, but all in the company of our friends. Still, the thing with the cops was so threatening and bizarre and unexplained. It made kissing seem kind of childish. For the moment, at least.
At least you can't see the scar, I say.
Jared's hands have helped the stitches already come out, but without slabs of makeup, there's still a hoof-made gash in my face. It'll heal more, I know, but the scar ain't going anywhere.
It's going to be fine, Mel says. Once the redness is gone, it might even look kind of amazing. Nobody really sees scars after the first time, Henna says. Not anyone who matters anyway.
Yeah, I say flatly. People who make fun of my face probably aren't my friends.
Henna reaches up and traces her fingers lightly over it, running down from the tip below my cheekbone, over the wider part on the flat of my cheek, to the little curlicue on the side of my chin. It's still you, she says. Everyone will be able to see you.
She keeps her fingers there for a second.
Yeah, I really want to kiss her again.
The scraggly man says back at the main counter while his prescription gets filled. Could I get a pack of Marlboros?
Mel grabs a pack off the rows of cancer-addled faces and tumored lungs in the racks behind her and rings it up. The man is still so obviously shy of us, he fumbles with his money, dropping a $5 bill on the ground. I lean to get it, but Henna's better placed. She lifts it up to him.
I know you, the man whispers, not looking her in the face.
He slides the $5 plus another $10 at my sister.
You do?
Henna asks. The man looks at her once, then away again shyly.
Timu,
he says.
Hannah slumps like her clothes suddenly weigh an extra 100 pounds.
Eric?
She says. Eric Pedersen? The scraggly man nods.
Oh, Jesus.
Hannah says under her breath, but out of surprise, not scorn. The scraggly man blushes anyway.
Strange shit going on,
he says, still not making eye contact.
I don't think it's vampires,
Hannah says.
No,
Eric says firmly.
They'd have come for me if it was.
There's an empty, silent moment where no one's blinking, and Eric is obviously growing more uncomfortable. Then,
Number 9,
says the voice of Pratip, the pharmacist over the loudspeaker, and Eric immediately heads off without looking at us again. We watch him go.
Friend of your brother's?
Mel gently asks.
In his band, Hannah says. Haven't seen him since it all ended. Guess he had a hard time coping.
She pulls her good arm into herself, almost visibly shrinking. I put my own arm around her and she leans into me. I kind of hate myself for thinking how nice it is.
That won't be us,
Mel says, meaning Eric. Whatever happens, that's not going to be us. And she says it like she's demanding a promise.
Your sister is like a cute little robot, Tina, our manager, says. I just want to eat her right up.
Meredith sits alone at a booth in Griller's. Jared's piled the table in front of her, the part not covered in homework and school hardware, with enough cheesy toast and blueberry lemonade to ruin every jazz and tap class she's ever taken.
I want a kid,
Tina says, looking at her hungrily from the waitress station.
Get one from Ronald, Jared says, stealing a fry from a plate.
He's infertile,
she whispers it louder than her normal speaking voice.
You should adopt, Jared says. Adoption is a moral good.
Tina makes a face.
Yeah, because Ronald's exactly the kind of guy who makes a good impression on a social worker.
She sighs, looking around Griller's.
Grumpy night. Everyone's in a bad mood.
She's right about that. I've had more complaints tonight than I've had in the last 6 months. One guy even sent back his water.
There's a weird feeling in the air, isn't there?
Tina says.
All those kids killing themselves at the high school.
Jared and I exchange a look but don't correct her.
You can feel it when you're driving home at night. God knows what could be out there in those woods.
Tina would have been 20 or so when the soul-eating ghosts came, so just that little bit too old to be directly involved. Still, you always wonder how much people know and just don't say, or pretend not to know, or purposely forget. Meredith leans out of her booth to catch my eye, even though she sat in Jared's section. He's more generous with the blueberry lemonade. I go over to her.
What's up?
She shows me her pad and swipes through a bunch of web pages.
There's nothing about it on the main news sites, not even if you search. You shouldn't be looking anyway. Leave it to me and Mel to take care of. But if you go to the right places,
she says, ignoring me, and opening a few locked-door discussion rooms on weird boards for things like obscure Japanese toys and underground video games. She turns the pad to me, several windows open. I want to keep scolding her, but I can't help but scan the pages. Lots of references to blue eyes and indie kids dying and the immortals. Lots about the immortals.
Most of it's speculation, Meredith says.
Immortals could mean a lot of things, but people are thinking maybe a kind of multidimensional thing. Or elves. Or angels, even. And the blue lights are an energy that kills you or brings you back to life or something. I'll bet that's what the deer were running from.
She sinks her chin down to her hands on the table.
Nobody knows for sure because the indie kids aren't talking to anybody but themselves. It's happening a lot of places, though, in some version or another.
Just like the vampires, I say almost to myself. Then I see her worried little face.
But you've got nothing to worry about. They never come after little mites like you.
What if they cancel bolts of fire?
She asks.
And you might think this is a 10-year-old asking a selfish question when people are dying.
Not Meredith. She's asking if everything's going to be all right. It probably will be, but when did probably ever help anyone?
Jeesh, people are cranky tonight, Jared says, coming over with the coffee pots. Want anything else, Meredbreth?
Fresh cheesy toast?
She asks in a small voice.
Jared smiles. Coming right up. Mel and Hannah just pulled in, by the way. He glances at me. Nathan's with them. I take the coffee pots from him and walk back to my side of the restaurant. Tina's already pouring out a Ronald tale of woe to Mel and Hannah by the front door.
And his toenails are like something out of a fable.
Hey,
I say. They say, hey, back. It's kind of like verbal tag, isn't it? Hey, here I am. Are you here with me? Yes, we are here with you. And everyone feels good because, hey.
I tip my head to Meredith's booth.
She's worrying, looking stuff up.
Mel sighs.
I told her not to, but I'm not surprised.
She heads over to our little sister.
Staff discount on whatever you guys want, Tina says.
Make somebody happy.
Thanks, Tina, I say.
She smiles and just stands there looking at me and Hannah. Then looking some more. Then looking some more. Then finally saying, oh, and heading off to force more cheesy toast on customers.
You okay?
I ask Hannah when Tina's gone.
Yeah, you?
Good. Weird. Good.
She smiles. Me too.
I swallow.
Listen, Hannah.
I know. Unfinished business.
She looks down at her cast, covered in ink by all the signatures. The biggest one is Jared's.
The smallest one is mine, but it's the only one she allowed on the palm of her hand.
I've been thinking, she says. Do you remember what I said just before we hit the deer?
Oh, shit.
Not really.
She knows I'm lying, but doesn't say.
You said you loved me, and I said I didn't think that was true.
You don't know that.
But I don't think you know it either, Mikey.
She taps her cast.
I do want to kiss you again, though.
I half grin.
In the name of exploration?
Three of your tables want their bills, Tina says, reappearing. They seem kind of pissy about it, too. Hannah's already heading over to Mel and Meredith, who are lengthily pretending to order from Jared.
I thought Nathan was with you, I say as she goes.
Still outside,
she says, shrugging.
And I wonder if she's kissed him in the name of exploration.
I get my three tables their bills. Only one of them leaves me a tip. I seat an angry-looking older couple who are already asking about the senior discount before they're even in their chairs, and this regular fireman who comes in every Saturday, orders the same thing, and just asks to be left alone as long as the all-you-can-eat shrimp keeps coming. I look back at Meredith's booth as I punch in their orders. Still no Nathan. I check around for Tina, then step outside, wiping my hands on a towel, feeling the pull of a loop that I want to wash and wash and wash them. I don't see Nathan anywhere, just oil stains, the traffic-resistant pine shrubs that border us, and a big open sky with a full moon beaming down. I head around toward the garbage area. Two big bins and a little brick hut that Jared and I are inevitably scheduled to wheel out every Sunday night. They smell unbelievably bad, even after we pour buckets of bleach into them.
There's no one there either.
I keep walking, still wiping my hands. Just being near the garbage area would do that to even a normal person. Not sure why I'm so curious or what I'm even thinking. I don't even like Nathan. I probably wouldn't want to see him killed, though. I'm beginning to get properly worried. I'm going to wipe my fingerprints off with this rag, when I turn the last corner and see him. His back against the brick of the restaurant outside the emergency exit. He's having a cigarette, but he doesn't look like he's hurrying. I stop in a shadow. Still wiping my hands, yes, but trying not to make a thing of it. Nathan's got a funny old face when no one's looking at it. Like he's almost an entirely different person. The saddest person I've ever seen.
Which is saying something.
And sure, he lost his sister, and he moves around a lot, and he used to be an indie kid.
He used to be an indie kid. The little mascot, he said.